I'd like to welcome everyone to this meeting of the House Committee on Higher Ed and Workforce Development. Today is Wednesday, the 5th of February, and I'd like to begin by following my first set of instructions. There's one change to our agenda, which we tried to get out late in the day. We do not have the fiscal on the dash two amendments for Bill 4020, so we are not going to work that today. Hopefully, we will be doing that Friday. Okay. I think that's the only other announcement. We will be going through House Bill 4147 and 4076 as planned for public hearings. And let's begin by opening a public hearing on House Bill 4147. Is Representative Buckley in the room?
I think so, sir.
Some guy that claims to be him, yeah. Or whatever.
When you're ready, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Representative Peter Buckley, representing Ashland and South Jackson County in the legislature. Thank you for having us here today to present our bill. Mr. Chair, you were gone during January Ledge Days, and the other members of your committee had to sit through about a 20-minute monologue on higher ed governance. So I'm going to try to win some favor by not doing that today and only speaking for a couple of minutes before I turn over the microphone. Look at the size of relief I can see from your colleagues. Turning over the microphone to the Oregon Student Associations, I'm bringing this bill forward on behalf of the Oregon Student Association. It does have to do with university governance, and the reason that I was very much willing to bring this bill forward is that there is a generational failure on our part. And I don't want to just be negative about it, but I think it needs to be acknowledged. We have not provided the same opportunities for the following generations that our generation, and I'm using our because I'm looking at the dais, and everyone except Representative Smith Warner, of course, is over 40. Our generation has not provided the opportunities to succeeding generations that we had going to college and entering into our adult lives. We have not provided that. When the issue comes up about the governance of our community colleges and our universities, the students are asking to have a voice in what happens to community college and university education in the state of Oregon. They're asking for their voice to be heard. We have not listened to them, and we have not met our obligation to them. I think we have an obligation to make sure their voices are heard. So what this bill is doing, it's saying as Oregon does a major change in higher education, community college education, our state education as a whole, with the whole pre-K through 20 effort that we're making, they want to be at the table. And they not only want to be at the table, but they want to have a voice in what is happening to their education. They feel just as passionate about education as any one of us. They're living it every single day. So what this bill is doing, it's asking as we develop the Higher Education Coordinating Commission that there be a student voice on that commission, that there actually be voting membership of students on that commission. They're asking that as we move to institutional boards for universities, that the students and the faculties of these universities have the ability to also have their voices heard on their campuses, both as terms of a voting representative for universities that have grad programs and undergrad programs, obviously, but also to be able to say, to give their opinion if a board member is acting in a manner which they feel is detrimental to their university and in their education. So that's the gist of this bill. That is what they're trying to accomplish. Overall, they're saying, let us have a voice, let us have a vote. They care as much as we do, and we certainly have not provided a higher educational opportunity that we can be proud of, though I am proud of our universities, and I think they do deserve a voice. With that, I'm glad to take questions on the bill, but I'm even more glad to pass the microphone over to the Oregon Student Association and the representative as they brought today from two of their campuses. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you for the condensed version and for bringing the bill forward. It is hard to start out an 8 a.m. meeting confronting our collective failures and shortcomings, but good that we're talking.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On a more optimistic note, I do believe that we are moving in good directions in Oregon. We have a long way to go. I don't want to be just pessimistic. I do believe we're moving in good directions.
Good to bring that up, too. Other questions, comments at this point? Okay. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have a few people signed up here, but let's begin with the students, Mario Parker Milligan, Tommy Letchworth, and Travis Mewison.
Mavison.
Mavison, thank you. Sorry about that.
No worries.
It looks like Mario is not. All right, when you folks are ready, dive in whatever order you want, and let us know who you are when you begin, please.
Hello. For the record, I'm Travis Mavison. I'm the Western Oregon University Student Body President and a Board of Director an OSA Board of Director. So thank you for your time this morning. So over the last couple months, I've had the privilege to talk to students and kind of discuss how Western and the Western students feel about the change in governance and what that's going to look like on the Western campus. And there's an overwhelming reaction that a lot of the students at Western Oregon felt like there wasn't enough conversation about technical and regional schools before this past last spring and before we started to make the transition for the technical regional schools this last couple months. Students are disheartened that the regional institutions were given so little consideration before the reorganization of higher education last year. As a student, I want to ensure that there's better representation for all students on the HEC. To allow for another student seat to show you take the role of a student serious in our institution would be amazing. But also to break down the representation from a regional school and a larger institution would also show the diversity among the institutions and the perspectives that they bring to the HEC. The fact that there's a wealth of educational options for students and the legislature respects and supports this. So please vote yes on student representation and local accountability and vote yes on HB 4147. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tommy Letchworth. I'm the student body president of Southern Oregon University. Thank you for having us today. I know it's early and cold, and so thank you for being here. I'd like to start out first with a simple statement in that students are the primary stakeholders in our institutions of higher education. Thanks to the almost two decades of statewide systemic divestment from our public universities, for example, Southern Oregon University receives about little under $13 million dollars less per biennium than we did in 2001, and yet we serve 1,000 more students. So this adds up to the fact that enrollment and especially tuition are incredibly important in our institutions, meaning that students provide the bulk of the operating revenue stream for universities these days. Now, as such, we are the primary stakeholders, right under Oregon taxpayers. However, those two terms are not mutually exclusive, and most of our students are taxpayers as well. And so, in a sense, we're being taxed twice to attend these institutions. As such, we feel we should have a say in the governance of our institutions. Second, we are, well, the population that is primarily affected by decisions rendered by governing bodies. As students, we're on the ground every day in the classrooms on campus, and we feel in a very real way the impacts of decisions that are made on our behalf by others. So, in terms of getting student voting rights back for the student seats on the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Now, we were stripped of our ability to vote on this governing body last legislative session, and we don't yet understand exactly why. However, it happened, and, well, quite frankly, we strongly disagree with that turn of events. Again, as the primary stakeholders, we feel that it's not only appropriate but essential for us as students to have the same rights as other Higher Education Coordinating Commission members, rights including but not limited to the ability to vote. Now, Executive Director Cannon, we had a good conversation a little while back, and he asked, well, I think you're focusing on the wrong thing. Is it so important that that you have those voting rights. You still have the ability to contribute to the dialogue. Our response was, well, if it's not that important, then why can't we have them? In terms of another student seat on the HEC, one for a technical or regional university, I'm sure the members of this body acknowledge the fact that the missions, the needs, and the experiences of technical and regional universities are rather different than those of research institutions, meaning that we have a different perspective, one that needs to be brought to the table. Now, the reason why we'd like to institutionalize a new seat on the HEC for technical and regional universities is because we'd like to avoid situations like the one we have now, where both students are on that board, or commission, excuse me, are from Lane County, one county in the state, both students. Even though they're one community college and one university, it doesn't represent the diversity of view that is necessary to govern, in our opinion. In terms of getting a grad student on the institutional board, in addition to the regular student, again, graduate students, their experience, their tuition, their fees are different than undergrads. As such, they come from a different perspective. And we feel that both perspectives need to be represented fully on our governance boards so that we can adequately represent the students that we're meant to serve. Finally, in terms of... A little loud. Sorry.
It just distorts when you're too close to it. Somewhat counterintuitive. So.
Okay. Sorry about that.
Okay.
Thank you for the adjustment. And this is my last bit. In terms of the local accountability clause, we feel most strongly about this. At this point, the only individual who has the ability to remove members of institutional governing boards is the governor of the state of Oregon. Now, when that is the same individual who recommends these folks for appointment, we're skeptical that, well, folks would be removed in the event that they are not doing their job, that they are not exercising sound judgment, unless there was a egregious violation. Now, as the, again, primary stakeholders of the institution, we feel that we should be able to have some say in terms of whether or not these folks are doing a good job. And we feel that it's important that if we do not feel our interests are being adequately represented, that we have a formal mechanism for voicing that. Thank you very much, and I'll pass it on to Eric. Sorry if I went a little long and distorted.
Good morning, Chair Harker, Vice Chairs Hoffman and Gallegos, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eric Knoll. I'm a student at PSU and serve as chair of the Oregon Student Association Board of Directors. Thank you for having us here today. And I'll be testifying in favor of House Bill 4147 on behalf of the Oregon Student Association. I want to address the necessity of the components in this bill by discussing the history of student voting seats and the importance of student involvement at a statewide level. Students are legitimate stakeholders, financial and otherwise, in the shared governance of our state and of our institutions. Oregon students have played a critical role in changing the landscape of higher education in Oregon as valuable voting members of the State Board of Education, State Board of Higher Education, the Oregon Student Access Commission, many statewide work groups, and the prior incarnation of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. My colleagues have discussed the necessity of continuing and expanding this trope through House Bill 4147 in their respective testimonies. At community colleges in Oregon, students have become the plurality stakeholders, and in some cases, like all Oregon public universities, the majority financial stakeholders. Due to this development over the last decade of tuition increases that have far exceeded inflation, students are shouldering the bulk of our institution's operating costs and therefore should be significant decision makers in the governance of our institutions of public post-secondary education. In addition to tuition payments, students are contributing to their institution's operating budgets through, one, the state general fund from their income taxes on the jobs they work to pay for school, and two, through property taxes either from their home or rent payments. Students will continue to make a very strong argument on these principles that we are valid decision makers and participants in statewide and institution-specific shared governance. To finish, we continue to hear from the legislature how important it is to have student voices in the room or to hear from the student perspective, and we very much appreciate that sentiment. However, in this 2014 session, this Legislative Assembly has the opportunity to move beyond sentiment and recognize the validity and legitimacy of not just the student voice, but student influence in statewide and institution decision-making. This committee, by a due pass recommendation, can continue to affirm yourselves as higher education allies in Oregon. And encourage your colleagues in the building to take action to validate students as well. That said, I strongly urge the passage of House Bill 4147. Thank you for your time, and we will take any questions if you have them.
Rep. Greenlee?
Thank you. I've had a chance to discuss this with Representative Buckley. I clearly am inclined to support the bill, but I'm troubled as a sociologist, citing complex organizations, with the recall provision of it. It seems to me students are important stakeholders, but so are other stakeholders of the state. I mean, the students as individuals pass through, but students are always there, but also so are citizens. I can see so much potential problems by having students doing periodic recall votes on members of the board. And there will be members of the board acting in good faith and acting the way they see their responsibility in ways that will piss students off. I mean, that is going to happen. And I'm not sure in any members of any kind of board can properly fulfill their function looking over their shoulders at, I think, maybe just the embarrassment or the stigma of having students voting to ask for them to be recalled on a basis during their term. They all serve for a term. When you have a large group of stakeholders on the board, including, we would hope, more students with voting rights on that board, it seems to me there needs to be more tolerance for differences of opinion. If a member of the board is acting totally irresponsibly, I think the governor has the opportunity to figure out how to deal with that. But at any rate, help me get more comfortable with the business of being able to call a vote of no confidence, which is essentially what we're talking about in this case, whether or not it has the impact of actually removing a member because of that lack of confidence. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a bit of a rambling question, but I hope you would address it for me to make me feel a little more comfortable.
Absolutely. Chair Harker, Representative Greenlee, thank you for the question. We definitely recognize that concern and have heard that concern from multiple elected officials in this building. The way we would respond at this point has to do primarily with the relationship building. Students, over the next couple of years, as changes in governance continue to unfold, look to continue our work to build relationships with the new governance structures and governance bodies within higher education. Traditionally, it's been expected that students approach these governance bodies and proactively on their end build relationships so that students may have a say or influence in what happens. By this provision, it would require that not only the students come to the center, but these institutional boards as well in building that relationship and building that positive engagement with the student body. In addition to the two-thirds vote by the Student Senate, it also requires a two-thirds vote by the Faculty Senate as well. So both have to occur before a formal review process takes place. And I would make the assumption that if students were trigger-happy, so to speak, on conducting these formal reviews, they would be taken less seriously by the governor's office. In our opinion, should be used wisely. And that's what we would, in the event of this passage, recommend to our student governments, is to take this responsibility very seriously. We understand that there will be differences in opinion between students and the boards that govern our institutions. But again, we hope to continue working on relationship building. It is one of our priorities throughout these major changes in governance. And I would hope that ultimately this legislature, an elected body, find a little bit of faith in students to do the right thing when the time comes.
Okay. Rep. Gallegos.
Thank you. I just wanted, in your arguments, you didn't include a notion that I think is really important, and that has to do with justice. and sort of a sense of democracy, and the principle being that all stakeholders should have a voice in the decision-making process. So for that reason, I'm supportive of your proposal, but I also wanted to follow up on Representative Greenlich's question. It just seems important to acknowledge that students do have a shorter window of opportunity in terms of participation. So I think this process is important for leadership development on the part of students, but it also carries with it sort of that more limited view that, as opposed to board members who might be on the boards for longer than 2 years or 4 years. So just taking that into account in terms of the responsibility of student representatives. Thank you.
I want to just applaud you all for coming and presenting your case here. While I agree that it would have been good to mention justice in there, I think, frankly, that your shareholder logic is a nice one. I have long thought that the state was a minority shareholder in the universities acting like the majority shareholder. And it's part of what has motivated me to be supportive of institutional local boards. I've got several other people signed up here. Thanks a lot for doing what you're doing. We'll have a serious discussion here at least. Okay?
All right. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Let's see. We have Ben Cannon, Hans Bernard.
Sure, tuition is a tax.
And it looks like the other folks want to go together. So let's just have you two gentlemen. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Harker, members of the committee. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Here, neutral on the bill, but to provide a little bit of context about how the Higher Education Coordinating Commission has gotten up and going, and a few thoughts on this question of student voting rights. First of all, I want to just express and acknowledge appreciation for the point of view that the students have expressed and the contributions that students on the HEC and on other state boards and commissions, as well as local governing boards, are already making. From the standpoint of the HEC, in our early meetings, the issues of, for example, textbook affordability, food insecurity, and other very student-centered and very important issues that wouldn't perhaps otherwise be on the minds of commissioners are ones that students have brought forward, and that's certainly, you know, very, very important. I would acknowledge and underscore the points that the previous speakers have made about the role of students as stakeholders, really the key stakeholders in this enterprise. And the HEC and its strategic plan that we hope to have the opportunity to present to this committee as it develops over the next several weeks really underscores that case for students as primary stakeholders in this work. As a commission, we, of course, work within the law that was adopted last session that does not provide those voting privileges for students. We have, however, adopted rules that establish that for HEC subcommittees and work groups, and we've created several of those two subcommittees and several work groups, students and other non-voting HEC members, faculty and staff, do have voting rights at the subcommittee level. In fact, we even have a chair of a work group who's one of our non-voting HEC members who chairs one of the work groups that reports to the HEC, and we've confirmed with DOJ, et cetera, that it was permissible to adopt rules that provide for those voting opportunities at the subcommittee level. We've also incorporated, I think, we've tried very hard and I think successfully to incorporate student voice at the full commission level. The commissioners sit on the dais, the 14 of them, 9 voting, 4 non-voting, 5 non-voting, without any distinction. It doesn't, you know, look that way. They sit interspersed, intermingled at the dais and operate under the leadership of Chair Nesbitt, operate with a real sense of equality, I think, at the dais. Just in sort of a comment or a couple of comments, I was thinking about all the energy that's been expended on this question of voting or non-voting at these university boards as well as at the Higher Education Coordinating Commission over the last year, and it's been considerable, and you were a part of that or were subjected to it, depending on your perspective, last session.
Amen.
And it strikes me that there is a distinction, or at least tends to be a distinction, between how a representative assembly like this one, a legislature or parliament, operates in this question of voting, and the way that a board, an executive board, a public board, a nonprofit board, tends to operate. And in that board setting, we operate almost entirely on the basis of consensus. I've worked through the governor's office in particular with quite a number of education boards, and I cannot remember the last time that the question came down to a 5-4 vote or 6-5 vote. It just tends not to be the spirit of how our executive boards and commissions operate, which isn't to say that it isn't an important question still and one worth this committee's consideration, but they do tend to operate under just a different sort of sense. And what may marginalize or empower a member of a board or commission, whether nonprofit, public, etc., tends not to be, I think, their voting status or lack thereof, but the spirit in which that member enters the conversation. Are they speaking authentically from their knowledge and experience? Are they working to build relationships with other members? Are they entering with or without a grudge, a feeling of superiority or inferiority? I think that's what tends to bring power to a conversation, or the lack thereof. And I want to express my complete understanding and appreciation of the point of view the students are bringing forward here. I am neutral on the bill. I suppose my only hope would be that however this issue is disposed of this session, it will be disposed of, and we will not be continuing to have the conversation about voting or non-voting on these boards and commissions, because I think there are so many far more, and I know that the students here share this view too. There are so many very much more important issues related to higher education that this committee and others, all of us, have to deal with in the sessions and years to come.
Good morning, Chair Harker, Vice Chair Huffman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Hans Bernard with the University of Oregon. The University of Oregon is here today with concerns and opposition to this bill. I would remind the committee that it was 7 months ago this week that the committee and this legislature took action to establish institutional governing boards at our three largest universities and reconstituted the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. The University of Oregon is of the strong belief that student representation is adequately and substantially enshrined in these two commissions, or in the Higher Education Coordinating Commission and the Board of Trustees. This committee received a memo from the National Center on Educational Management Systems, NCHEMS, in the deliberations on House Bill 3120 that provided a recommendation from national experts that you have worked with, that there not be constituencies and voting members on the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. We agree with that standpoint. As a report, our Board of Trustees met for the first time a couple of weeks ago, and our student member, also happens to be our student body president, was a full participating voting member of our Board of Trustees and was a great addition to what I believe will be a very dynamic team that will push the University of Oregon forward. On the third provision of the bill requiring the governor to investigate board members that are voted on by students and faculty members that have raised concerns on particular board members, we would simply defer to the governor's office on that question, but would raise the point that we think it would create some significant challenges for operations of the Board of Trustees. So I'm happy to respond to any questions you might have at this time, but just did want to raise our concerns and put things on the record. Thank you.
Okay, thank you both. Questions or comments for this panel? Rep. Gorsuch.
Mr. Cannon, I have a question for you. the operations that you described in terms of a fairly collegial sort of work group situation, would you say that that is because of the current administration, or would you say that's a general thing that would transcend one governor's regime over another?
Representative Gorsuch, Chair Harker, members of the committee, I don't have deep enough experience with executive boards and commissions to answer the question, I think, very credibly. Certainly looking across all of the boards and commissions, and there are many in education in the executive branch that I've worked with, that collegiality is prevalent. That was true even in the first years. I came to the governor's office about 8 months after he took office this term. That was true and remains true even with significant numbers of appointees from the previous administration. I guess one can envision that becoming more, in a gubernatorial transition, becoming a more combative, but they tend, in the same way that legislative committees, frankly, tend to be collegial places. There are times, of course, when it does come down to that divided right. committee, but you work so hard for that not to be the case. And something about the size of an entity like this one, very similar to the size of the HEC and most of our boards and commissions, brings forward that. I think that best side of human nature to draw sort of closer to each other and try to seek consensus.
Follow up?
Yes, please.
The gentleman, I'm sorry, I don't remember your name, from the University of Oregon.
Hans.
So what would be your key objection to having student stakeholders on the HEC here voting?
I think our position at this point is we believe that there are student stakeholders on the HEC. We don't believe that there is a problem with the current structure, and we believe that there is good processes in place with the structure that Director Cannon outlined, subcommittee participation, and we don't see that there's a need at this point to change the way the commission is comprised.
So are you... Follow up,
please. Thank you. Go ahead.
So are you indicating that there's somehow a philosophical difference between students and other members on the commission? And if so, I'd be interested to know what that is.
I can't speak for other members of the commission, Chair Harker, Representative Gorsuch. I can say that that from the University of Oregon perspective, the public policy as outlined in the structure and voting designations of certain members of the commission is consistent with what this committee has seen and been recommended as best practice. And at this point, there has not been a problem with the structure and the voting composition as to date.
So, follow up?
One more.
Okay, last one. So what you're saying is, essentially, you don't feel it's broken, so you don't need to make any changes to it.
Chair Harker, Representative Gorsuch, correct.
Okay, thank you.
To be continued. Rep. Gilliam, and then Rep. Greenland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cannon, is it true that you're just bitter because you no longer have a vote here in the I was looking at the ratio, and I counted 8.
Please.
A chance to answer that.
Yeah, really.
I count eight new under this bill.
What's the ratio? Remind me of the ratio and how that would change if, in fact, they became voting members. You are now.
So our commission, Representative Gilliam, Chair Harker, our commission, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, has 14 members. And I think the language here is important. We call them all members of the commission. They're all commissioners. 5 of them are non-voting members. 2 of those 5 are students, 2 are faculty, and 1 is staff. So we have 9 voting public members, so they're not designated faculty, staff, students, and then we have 5 non-voting staff, faculty, students, and this bill would add, double check, but it adds a 3rd student and creates voting, I believe. Yes. So my understanding of this bill, and I would defer to the proponents here, but my understanding of this bill is that it would create a 15th commissioner and it would establish that 11 of the 15, sorry, 12 of the 15 are voting.
Rep. Greenman?
Representative Cannon, I'd like to sort of echo the students' comment in their testimony and reaction to you, in a sense. I tend to agree with you about the nature of these boards. So therefore, the question of who's a member and who's not a member, and this committee didn't get to voice that very seriously in the debate on it, is largely symbolic. And the question is, the symbolic nature of having students with full voting membership has some value in its own right, and if it doesn't matter, I mean, if the boards are going to work together and it's not about a 7-5 vote out of the 12, why wouldn't we want to honor the symbolism of recognizing, elevating the symbolism of the students as being full members of the commission?
Representative Greenlink, Chair Harker, I'm neutral, and I would only and I appreciate and understand that argument. I would point out, and it, I think to echo the letter that Hans referred to from National Center on Higher Education Management, which made the recommendation not to include students, faculty, or staff as voting members, I would only note that symbols point both ways. There's the symbolism, I think an important symbolism, of incorporating and including students as full voting members. There's also the symbolism of a board that is neutral, does not have stakeholders directly involved in the voting on their budgets, scholarships, etc. And that symbol was the one that the legislature, I think, leaned towards last session in establishing, you know, going the route it did with 3120. So I have a hard time coming, you know, weighing one of those symbols more strongly than another. I would just point out that symbol, that the symbolism of a stakeholder neutral board taking up serious public policy issues on behalf of the citizens of Oregon related to higher education was important.
May I ask a follow-up question, please? This is a very important question. I've been involved in a board where, when they got into a big problem, certain members were excused from, weren't given the full rights. Are you suggesting that the non-voting members are full members in every regard except their ability to vote? They sit, they're in executive session, they have access to all materials, they have access to all meetings, is that?
Representative Greenlink, Chair Harker, To make a definitive statement, I would need to consult, again, our rules and perhaps DOJ around particular situations. We have not encountered those situations yet. As you know, our board is not fully empowered until July 1st. But we have operated, and I believe our rules reinforce the notion that they are full members in every respect except for the vote, and that would be, include executive session. It would not include the vote, obviously. So, again, I will double check this after I return to my office, because we did have some conversations with DOJ and the development of the rules to talk about some of those types of possibilities. But certainly the intent of the chair, the intent of the commission in adopting the rules, was to incorporate our non-voting members in the fullest extent possible under the law. And, of course, the law does not permit the voting.
Mr. Chair, it would be very important to have that information before us, because it does make it. And, for example, if they would be excluded from executive session, that would be huge problem.
So. Representative Greenlink, Chair Harker, I'd be happy to follow up on that.
Okay, great. Thanks. I provide that to Victoria then, and we'll all have it. Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ben, you alluded to it in your testimony, but I think let's just call it the soil. It's been plowed on this issue over the last, a couple sessions, really. And I think, you know, again, thinking back to last session and the work that went into Senate Bill 270, House Bill 3120, and this was a topic, or these, you know, faculty and student representation on both institutional boards and the HEC was something that we, in our committee, you know, talked about many occasions in the work groups that were working on those bills. It was something that was constantly being addressed. And I think it's fair to say that at the end of the day, what came out was a compromise. And I think actually a lot of people referred to that as the Monroe Compromise, not Monroe Doctrine. But if you remember the legislative path that these vehicles took, but the compromise was to allow for student and faculty representation on the institutional boards, but to try to preserve the HEC as a non-stakeholder membership, because the HEC has a different role, a different mission, i.e. crafting policies and thinking about innovative strategies good for the whole of Oregon rather than specific representation. And that really was a pretty hard-fought battle, as you well recall, I think, and some of us were in the middle of that. So it's not really a question, but just a comment that, you know, we've been engaged in this issue for a long time in this building, and I feel good about, I think, where we landed, because I do think it allows for student representation, values their input, their perspective. But I think regarding where we're at right now, I would be reticent to make some changes this abruptly when we just have set off down this pathway. And institutional boards and the HEC are in the process of trying to get their feet underneath them and figure out what this new dynamic is all about. And I would be reticent to make changes at this point because I think it could be unsettling to the process. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good points. And as you said, Hans, it's only been 7 months since we got going. And it's easy to forget that when we're in the fray in the building here. So, Rep. Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I am used to the fact that Rep. Johnson often beats me and takes what I was going to say. And I'm not offended. I welcome that at any time.
Rep. Johnson would be offended.
I recognize the fact. Rep. Greenlick goes on the record. I recognize the fact we come into the building every year now and assess programs and look at areas that we need to make changes. Yeah, I'm a part of that. I get it, and I'm more than willing to do that. What Rep. Johnson said, though, this was there was a lot of energy put into 3120 and 270 and everything that surrounded it. And we're just getting into this. I was sitting here envisioning a passenger van that pulled out. It's going 65 down the highway now, and we don't want to slow the process down by any means, but somehow we want to throw another person onto that van while it's moving 65. And we haven't even figured out, you know, if things are going to go well. I think we could and should remain open into the future to look at this, you know, do an assessment a couple of years down the road. Let's see how it's going to work. You know, some of us did give in, excuse me, and agree to students and faculty and a good mix of people on the HEC board and looking at institutional boards and whatnot. I personally don't think this is the time to start looking and making changes. I made some comments. What's up with that? Made some comments last week at the back in the table groups I was in at the higher ed symposium that Duncan Weiss had put together. And I said, you know, a lot of our problems will be resolved in education and higher ed if we remember that we need to be student-focused. The students are the clients, they're the customer, they're the focus, they're the main stakeholders, if you will. And it might sound like I'm making the argument for adding another voting position on the board, but my contention is that if the current HEC and institutional boards and even local school district boards, if they remain focused on the goal of the students,
the students are going to be taken care of. Their focus will be taken care of appropriately as it has been designed. And I just wanted to get that on the record, too, that remind everybody we need to be student-focused. But I think it's premature to be reopening this issue to make changes.
Deb Gorsuch.
Mr. Cannon, I have a question for you. In terms of the current makeup of the HEC board, can you refresh us in terms of how that selection goes and the sorts of folks that are on it?
Yeah, Representative Gorsuch, Chair Harker. The governor is responsible for appointing the members subject to Senate confirmation for voting members. with the exception of students who serve two-year terms, members serve four-year, are appointed for four-year terms. The nine voting members are members at large. They're public members. One, there has to be representation from each congressional district. So there is a provision for geographical diversity among the nine voting members. They were, I think the statute says little, if anything else, relative to qualifications. The governor, in his appointments, sought people who, some of whom have very deep experience and even work experience in higher education, the majority of whom do not have work experience in higher education, but do have sort of policy background or community-based experience that lends itself to the topic. You know, the governor, I think, in his appointments was guided, his appointments to the HEC was guided by many of the same principles that guide his appointments to other boards and commissions, which have to do with really commitment to service, broad point of view, you know, rigorous and flexible thinkers, a set of characteristics that I think helps to represent the people of Oregon effectively. The statute is virtually silent on those requirements.
Okay.
Follow up?
Just one.
One. Because we still have another panel of students.
Oh, okay.
And another.
So, in terms of the selection process, then the governor is most likely, though, going to want to select people who are interested and concerned about education. Would you say that's correct?
Representative Gorsuch, Chair Harker. Yes, that's correct. And I should have noted that in the governor's appointments to the non-voting, the faculty, staff, and student positions to the HEC, he sought nominations from student groups, so OSA in the case of the students, faculty groups, and staff groups, and worked with those nominations and those groups very closely to bring forward members who were, you know, I think closely aligned with the stakeholders who, mm-hmm. In some respects, they represent.
So really, except for the fact that they go to school, the students have the same sort of interests and concerns as everybody else on the board. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Representative Gorsuch, Chair Harker, I'd be reluctant to sort of characterize the interests or perspectives of members, but generally speaking, I think the students ably represent the point of view in particular of students, which with, you know, the hundreds of thousands right. of Oregonians who are enrolled in higher education, I think is typical of the characteristic right. and point of view of many, many Oregonians.
Okay. So my concern is, I mean, everybody should just vote if they're all on the same page, essentially.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, everyone, on that, including you two gentlemen. Thank you very much.
Thank
we
you.
Have four students, I believe. Elizabeth Hardart, Steve McAllister, Herbert Rotwin, and Richard Wagner.
Mr. Chair, while they're coming up,
yes.
Could we ask our ledge counsel for an opinion on whether non-voting members have the full rights of every other member? Would that be something they could do when they weren't quite so busy with getting amendments to all the current bills?
Sure, let's do it. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah,
good idea.
Let them do their job.
Yeah, not right now. Okay, very good. Thanks. Welcome all. I see you all managed to squeeze in there. So please introduce yourselves and let us hear your stories.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth Ann Hardart, and I'm from Philomath in Benton County. I'd like to start off by letting y'all know that I'm a true product of the Oregon education system. I received my associate Oregon transfer degree from Lane Community College before getting my bachelor's at Southern Oregon University, and am now a graduate student at Oregon State University. Additionally, as a native Eugenian, I attended classes at the University of Oregon, so I've really had a chance to see Oregon education, higher education, from almost every viewpoint you can. Which brings me to the reason I came here today to speak to you. It was asserted that student voices are adequately represented on these boards, but I would disagree because graduate students are a unique population with unique needs, and it's very difficult for other people to speak to those needs. Additionally, because we are such a small population compared to the undergraduates, oftentimes our voices go unheard simply due to lack of representation. But we are both the present and the future of academia. We're unique in that on campus we attend classes, but we also teach the classes. And many of us will be teaching for the rest of our careers. So when the representative from Ashland who proposed this bill spoke of the generation gap, we are your bridge for that generation gap. So I think it's very important to have a specific place for graduate students on these boards because of our unique perspective and unique needs. Additionally, it gives you the chance to move forward on the institutional boards. I believe that the Higher Education Commission, I'm sorry, the HEC, and the institutional boards were formed in recognition of a need to move forward. And without our voices, I worry that only the past and the present will be represented, whereas we can offer that bridge, which I spoke of, to the future. As for some of Representative Greenlick's concerns, I'd like to speak from personal experience. I was recently appointed to the University Health and Safety Committee, and many concerns were brought up from the administration and the committee, that as a graduate student, I am a transitory in nature on campus, that I would provide a limited perspective to the committee and perhaps be a rabble-rouser. However, through my service on the University Health and Safety Committee, I don't believe that any of those concerns have come to fruition, in that I received a personal thank you from the Assistant Vice President of the University for my service and for bringing issues to light which they previously did not have access to. And so that is my personal story, and I'd like to pass the mic.
Hi. Chair Harker, Vice Chairs, Committee and Representatives. I'm Richard Wagner. I'm a physics graduate student at the University of Oregon. I'm currently the president of the physics graduate students, and I am in my fifth year of graduate school studying quantum mechanics in the department. I want to speak to the importance that the graduate students share to the university society and campus community. We are researchers. We are students. We are teachers. There's no other group on campus. There's no other group of people on campus that meet all the qualifications we have. We are a unique perspective that offer unique insights and information to share with the campus community and better the community. I want to share a specific example with you. A few years ago, another graduate student in a physics department was interested in increasing his teaching ability, so he reached out to his advisor, and together they put together a group to study pedagogy and sciences. That group has since grown to receive a major grant from the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and it has been able to hire a full-time staff as well as two part-time staffs. There have been dozens of courses that have been remodeled and created out of this organization that was suggested by a graduate student. It has fundamentally changed how science education, and specifically science education for non-science majors at the University of Oregon, has proceeded. It has been a boon to our group. We have brought in national education experts to speak to us and lead workshops. This is just one example of how the graduate students have the ability to increase and benefit the campus community and the education. As for, it has been mentioned that the students are students, but it was kindly pointed out as my associate from Oregon State, the undergraduate population may not speak for the graduate students. They do not have the perspective and knowledge and experiences that we have, and how we interact with the community and the campus is fundamentally different from them. Thank you.
All right, so good morning. I'm Chair Harker, representatives, committee members. Thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to speak this morning. My name is Steve McAllister. I'm a graduate teaching fellow at the University of Oregon in the Department of Biology, where I've been a student, a researcher, and a teacher for the last 6 years. I'm out this year. Going to graduate, get my PhD.
Congratulations.
And I wanted to speak to you today in favor of HB 4147, and in particular of the provision for graduate student involvement in the institutional boards. It's been mentioned, a lot of what's been talked about here has been the idea of student representation. And I'd like to focus less on the idea of representation and more on the idea of perspective. With respect to Mr. Hans from the University of Oregon, the president of the student body at the university does not have the same perspective as a graduate student teacher and researcher might. And I think, as Mr. Cannon was pointing out, that these boards are not adversarial fields of battle where it's a question of who has enough votes to get their particular agenda advanced. It's supposed to be a collegial and cooperative institution that is working to make that university the best educational institution and research institution it can be. And for that, you need as many perspectives as possible, right? You need as many different ways to look at the mission of that university and how it can accomplish that mission. And as both teachers and students who interact regularly with faculty and undergraduates in a variety of different capacities, as mentors, as colleagues, as teachers, we can bring a very unique perspective to the boards that will be good for the university, for the institutional board. And I think now is the time. If I could speak really briefly to Representative Johnson's and Vice Chair Huffman's concerns about not wanting to stop the ban. I don't think we're really to the point where we're on the highway going 65 yet. I think if we want to use the van analogy, it's just now pulling away from the front of the building. And the grad students are running out. We're pulling our coat on. Sorry, you know, the alarm was late. We're coming. Wait for us. Now is the time when you're just pulling away to step on the brakes real quick and let us jump in the back. The going 65 miles down the highway is going to be a year from now, 2 years from now, when these boards are fully established and they have their internal structure put together without that graduate student input and insight as both teachers and students. So I just want to urge you to actually take now as the opportunity to make sure everybody's on the van before it's really off and down the road. Thank you.
Hello, committee. Thank you for having us here to speak today. My name is Herbert Grodewall. I am a physics graduate student at the University of Oregon. I am in my fifth year currently. I also do research in the field of optics, but I study surface interactions with light and metals. I always have the disadvantage of going last, so everything I'm going to be doing is echoing what has been said before me. It is very important to note that graduate students are not the same as undergraduates in the fact that we are both students, but we have different life perspectives at this point. There is a large percentage of graduate students, well, a significant percentage of graduate students that have families, something that is very uncharacteristic in undergraduates. And in the same regard of where we're educators and researchers, we're not the same as professors and faculty in the fact that we are still, we're the up-and-coming generation. We have new ideas that we can bring to the table, and we have those fresh ideas. One other thing that I would like personally to talk about, my own interest in how I came to become a graduate student at the University of Oregon. When applying to graduate schools and being visiting them, I was very surprised to discover that our physics department actually had its own internal structure, and that allowed us to have a say in what we do within our own department, a physics department. I think having this representation for graduate students on the board of trustees is a very important recruiting tool to know that if people come here, they have their voice heard. They know that they are being represented by their group. And I think that's a very important thing. Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
I just want to say personally, this is a really challenging issue for me, for someone who was at the University of Michigan when the Graduate Student Union was being formed and there were campus-wide strikes. It's really resonating with me. On the other hand, I do respect the contortions that this body went through in the previous session and the complexities of hammering out that agreement that we all reached, and it's a tough decision. What other comments or questions do we have for this panel at this time, folks?
Are there more?
None?
We have other folks testify.
No, is there anyone else here who is hoping to testify on this bill? I don't have anyone else signed up. No.
Then I would like to say something on the record.
Please do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As we talk about restructuring before we are fully empowered, as Director Cannon said, I don't think students will find much comfort in the, you know, wait and see kind of argument. But why would we move ahead so quickly? I want to say something about the van. And just extend this a little further. I want to say something about the van driver. And I would say this, that there may come a time when we need to restructure and do this. You can't just say, we've got good people in place, and let's see how it works. And there's no way we know who the next governor is going to be. Who that governor, he or she, might appoint. But I hope there will be some comfort in knowing that the van driver that this governor has chosen is the person that he, when he describes justice and fairness, this is a person who seeks compromise and not confrontation, and I can tell you that from personal experience as being a co-chair of Ben Gannon. So I think we should find great comfort in his comments as a neutral person, but also in his leadership as we go forward to a time where it may be appropriate to do this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well said. Yes,
Mr. Chair.
What about Rook Johnson?
I just want to apologize to everybody for using the van analogy.
Too late, man. Too late.
It kept the discussion going.
All right. Thank you all very much. Thanks to everyone who has testified. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4147. And let me take a 5-minute break here. Let's take a breather. We'll come back and
pronounced.
Okay, welcome back, everyone.
How much did that cost?
Nearly everyone. What I would like to do now is, from Rep. Johnson, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4076. While Rep. Johnson is getting situated, would you like to give a very brief summary of what this bill will do for us, please, Victoria?
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 4076 directs Eastern Oregon University, Oregon Institute of Technology, Southern Oregon University, and Western Oregon University to develop pilot programs for fixed-cost bachelor's degrees and establishes criteria for pilot programs, requires the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to report status of and recommendations for pilot programs to the Legislative Assembly, declares an emergency and is effective on passage. You should also have in your packets Dash 1 amendments relating to requirements for financial fact sheets.
Thank you very much. Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Harker. Members of the committee, good to see you. And Rep. Gilliam, you look really good from this perspective, too.
Thank you very much.
That's great.
Thank you, Governor. I appreciate it.
You all are familiar with many of the concerns that exist, not just in Oregon, but across the country regarding student debt, the time it takes to get through a process, sometimes to get from completion to get your degree, and to access that career that you have your heart and your ambition set on. So this bill is an attempt to work within that. I have had an opportunity, as long as maybe some of you, to attend some conferences across the country over the past few years, and the topic of student debt, the pathway to get to completion, is a topic that's of prime focus across the nation, not just here in Oregon. So factoring all of those factors into this bill, we've tried to boil it down and come up with an Oregon solution for this, and not solution, but Oregon innovation. They try to take that issue on and to come up with a way to be innovative, to be relational, to be collaborative with all our entities within the higher ed world as we work towards some solutions. So I'll go ahead and walk you through my testimony, and then be happy to take any questions at the end of the panel. House Bill 4076 instructs the true campuses, and again, let's define our terms again, because we're now calling the regionals the technical and regional universities, so that's what TRUE stands for here. But House Bill 4076 instructs the true campuses to develop a pilot program that offers fixed-cost bachelor degrees. The two degrees in this pilot must be offered as a part of each pilot with at least one degree having a direct connection to the workforce needs of the associated region in which the institution exists. The tuition price of degrees offered should be at a comparatively reduced cost than the current rate. Pilots created under 4076 can be replicated from programs already in place at each university. The HEC shall then be involved as a collaborator to ensure accreditation standards are met, to help development of a tracking method to record results of each pilot, and to address questions of incentivizing, funding, and long-term sustainability of each pilot. House Bill 4076 states the pilot program should be operational by the fall of 2015, with a follow-up report to the legislature during the 2021 session. If we're going to achieve 40-40-20 by 2025, we must incorporate innovative pathways that reflect the adapting landscape of higher education. The presidents of the TRUE campuses have taken a proactive approach by developing modern pathways while accounting for the needs of students. The tuition debt is a pressing issue among students, and by employing new methodologies, as we see happening at Southern, increasing dual accreditation through regional partnerships, as we currently see happening at Eastern, guaranteeing a fixed tuition, as we see happening, has been trying to happen at Western, or forging private-public partnerships, as OIT is doing. Each of these universities have provided new opportunities for their students to be successful without the burden of crippling debt. House Bill 4076 recognizes these efforts and builds upon them. The intent of House Bill 4076 is to compel a conversation between the TRUE campuses and the HEC to produce stable, innovative, and low-cost pathways for achieving a bachelor's degree. 4076 can be differentiated from other legislation because it does not introduce a new concept, but rather allows the TRUE campuses to advance their own mission, calls on the strategic plan of the HEC to promote this mission, and incorporates the incentivizing of innovative pathways, which all combine to promote the economic and social goals of 40-40-20. Passage of 4076 will move Oregon further along in the attainment of a quality and innovative public education system and subsequent workforce development. In a draft of its 2014 strategic plan, the HEC outlines the shift from managing the sustainability of educational institutions to ensuring that students can maximize their success in the public education system. This shift includes a focus on, quote, the creation of seamless pathways by which students can advance at their best pace, learn in their best environments, and achieve to their full potential, end quote. 4076 envisions individualized pilots that utilize a variety of tools and methodologies: dual accreditation, online and distance learning, proficiency-based learning, regional partnerships between high schools, community colleges, and universities, and even public-private partnerships, as I mentioned. These tools are vital to reaching all types of learners. House Bill 4076 supports True Campuses to continue their work while calling on the HEC to collaborate on how these pathways can be expanded and encourage students to reach their full potential. With 2 degrees included in the pilots, there will not be an overwhelming burden on the universities to restructure their current and entire system. Rather, it will be an opportunity to revisit current practices and accounting for the governance changes within the entire public education system. The HEC mission states, quote, our success will require more than good intentions or the construct of aspirational goals. It will require reinvention, recommitment, and reinvestment, end quote. House Bill 4076 draws from this statement to promote incentivizing initiatives to embed them into our university structure. True presidents demonstrated their commitment and invested financially in the success of their students. House Bill 4076 calls on the HEC to address reinvestment opportunities through a conversation that must include further research of funding formulas and their correlation to higher education attainment. Reinvesting and incentivizing is a key to providing fixed-cost bachelor degree at a reduced tuition rate. House Bill 4076 highlights the funding aspects required to increase the amount of students who achieve baccalaureate degrees while employing the HEC to solidify its strategic mission and therefore will have a positive impact upon the entire system of education in Oregon. The pilots envision in House Bill 4076 move the needle on delivering education and support the connection between the education and the workforce. In the current education landscape, students are required to learn a specific curriculum and then translate that knowledge into a skill set that employers need. Often the education and skills are not directly correlated. Statistics show that there are a high number of STEM-related employment opportunities available in Oregon, yet many of those jobs go to out-of-state applicants. This is a strong example of how the education and workforce relationship needs to be strengthened. House Bill 4076 requires at least 1 degree offered to have a clear connection to the regional workforce needs, giving students a direct link to future employers. Vice versa, employers will be encouraged to engage with the scholastic institutions in a form of internships, workshops, and/or curricula assistance. I believe House Bill 4076 is a timely piece of legislation that will remain valid throughout the remaining of higher education, of higher education in Oregon. The collaborative process between the HEC and True Campuses addresses 40-40-20 by removing barriers to higher education achievement and recognizes the adaptive and flexible atmosphere needed to consistently promote student-centered outcomes. Now, Mr. Chair, you mentioned the Dash 1 amendments. The Dash 1s were conceived and put together to try to address some of the concerns that we heard. My staff and I have been actively talking with and consulting with the presidents at the universities and so forth, and one of the comments we heard oftentimes was that we'd love to dive in, we'd love to work with you on this, but there could be some financial obvious barriers to making this possible. So what the Dash 1s do is attempt to clearly show that each university, as they engage in this process and they work with the HEC, will include a financial fact sheet that sets forth the university's projected costs in establishing, operating, and maintaining these pilot programs. First of all, so they list their cost. What would it cost them over and above what they currently do to make this happen? Secondly, then, they dare to develop long-term and financial sustainable pilot programs. When developing the pilot programs here, the commission now, the HEC, must consider the financial fact sheet created and any funding for any modifications that would improve the long-term financial viability of the pilot programs. What's envisioned here, and as you well know, the HEC has many, many initiatives that they're dealing with right now, and one of them is how can we modify, tweak, if you will, our funding formulas for higher education in order to incentivize particular types of outcomes. How can we create incentives? How can we change how we fund certain degree pathways or certain types of degrees in Oregon in order to get the kind of outcomes that we're looking for? So this amendment directly relates to that. It's not at all, we don't at all envision a process here where the institutions would incur greater debt or financial hardship, but what we envision is a process where they and the HEC together can say, this, the universities would say, this is what we would like to do. We think this meets the needs of our region, the needs of our students. The HEC can then say, okay, this is how we can help you perhaps be able to roll this out and to pilot this. So that's what's in play. I would also add, I think I've got, obviously, you know, there will be perhaps some differing of opinions about whether this is feasible or possible or not. And I would just say that, you know, this bill is not intended to be a silver bullet. This is not going to fix the high cost of tuition. It's not going to fix higher ed affordability in Oregon. But I do believe it can be a key piece of a puzzle going forward. As I said, we're not the only state that are considering creating new innovative pathways to degree to completion at a reduced cost. I also would say that we've been intentional to not create an overly prescriptive pathway. Some states have, I think as I mentioned in the informational hearing back in January, some states have come up with, governors in fact have said, I want a 10K BA in this state. Florida would be one of those, Texas being another one. And those states have attempted to comply with that to varying degrees of success. I don't think anyone would say that it's had broad-based success in either one of those states. We don't attempt to put a price tag on this because each state is different regarding its level of funding of higher education. A 10K BA in Texas is going to be, it's not an apples-to-apples comparison because the level of state support is vastly different. But we have gone out of our way to try to make this as accommodating as possible and allow each university to come up what's best for them. And as we create an atmosphere perhaps of innovation and a collaboration, one university may be able to inspire another university to be as aggressive as they can. But third, I think the other point that I know I've heard, and it will be brought up likely today, is that the regionals at this point in time just don't simply have the bandwidth or the capacity to take this on. We understand that there are still governance issues that are being addressed and are in the process of being worked out. We understand that some of our regionals, at least a couple of them, are on some, they're in the process of doing some financial reorganization in order to make them more whole for the going forward and so forth. It's interesting, I think you have in OLIS, or I don't know if you have it in front of you, but we do have testimony from both presidents at Southern and at Eastern, which I think are probably the two universities that are experienced the most challenging fiscal environment at this time, who have said they're willing and ready to go to work on this process. And they have, in fact, taken the idea back to their campuses and had a chance to discuss this with their faculty. And there's some genuine excitement about thinking outside the box about at least a couple of degree pathways that we could do that would be different than what we currently offer, taking into account all of the different partnerships that they have in the region. Eastern, obviously, through the Eastern Promise, has gone far beyond what we see happen elsewhere in the rest of the state. And some of this could hopefully be a good model for what could be replicated elsewhere. Let me just sum up a few points, Mr. Chair, and then I'd be happy to take any questions. Again, House Bill 4076 envisions a collaborative process over the next few years involving the universities, the HEC, and the legislature to design a greater number of affordable degree pathways that can lead to sustainable careers in Oregon's economy. I think it's important to recognize that the students of the future are going to drive the marketplace. They are going to be the consumers, and they're going to go where they feel that their dollars, their resources can get them to that career, to that job, to that pathway that they're looking for in the most cost-effective and direct way possible. It would be my hope that House Bill 4076 would begin a process of cooperation and collaboration that will lead to innovation in degree pathways that our students that seek a more direct and affordable avenue to a career can take advantage of. So Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Rep. Johnson. I appreciate what you're trying to do here. Questions or comments? None right now. Why don't you come back up here and join us?
Thank you.
Let's hear. We've got four people signed up here. Let's hear them in pairs. Dr. Karen Marindale and Dr. Mark Perlman. Get you two up, please.
Good morning, Chair Harker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Karen Marinchell. I'm the Interim Vice Chancellor for Academic Strategies at the Oregon University System. I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today about this very important concept. Representative Johnson and I have been talking about some of these ideas recently and over the last couple of years. And so I just want to highlight a few points about the bill. As Representative Johnson mentioned, we know that there's no silver bullet to this issue, and yet we are all extremely concerned about the cost of higher education for our students. And so we're looking forward to continuing to work with you on solutions. And this is an exciting solution. I'm very excited about the Dash 1 amendments. I think that the fiscal information is going to be critical. We would love to offer less tuition to our students. We would love to have them pay less tuition. But we know that we're already highly cost-effective, that we're the 46th state in the nation in terms of statewide funding. So you know all of this. So we would love to be able to work on some solutions that do offer lower-cost degrees to our students. I'm not going to go into details about some of the other models that are out there around the country, but the jury's still out on a lot of those, and some of them Representative Johnson mentioned. What we do know is that they're serving just a very small proportion of students, and students who are already equipped to be successful in college. So in Texas, for instance, many of the requirements for students to enter into the $10,000 degree programs are quite slim. So these are students for whom we know are going to be successful in college, whether they're paying $10,000 or more for their degrees. I do want to speak a little bit to some of the particulars with the technical and regional universities. As Representative Johnson mentioned, they're undergoing a lot of changes right now, and so we do have a concern about their capacity, both in terms of their staff bandwidth as they're taking on more responsibilities from the chancellor's office, and as they pursue institutional boards, they're going to need to staff up on their own campuses. And so staff bandwidth is, of course, a concern. And then, as Representative Johnson had mentioned, some of our campuses are also doing a lot of tightening right now for their budget. So they're just getting a better picture of how their financials and programs are working together on their campuses, and some of them are undergoing some significant changes as we speak. We also know that tuition is not the major cost driver for many students. So room, board, incidentals also are typically more expensive for students than tuition is. This isn't to say that we shouldn't focus on trying to find ways to lower tuition costs for students, but we also must recognize that there are other costs that drive the price of college up for students. Many of the fixed cost degrees that are out there in other places tend to mask early college credit and credit for prior learning, which also have costs associated with them. So we'd want to be very careful about the pathways that we outline. And the idea behind many of the fixed cost degrees is to fill in where colleges have excess capacity. So you might envision that empty seats in classrooms where we're getting no tuition, it would be good to have even some tuition in those classrooms. We need to think about this carefully, and I think that this bill would give us the opportunity to do that. For instance, many of the universities have stopped offering tuition plateaus, which would essentially have done that. So students pay a certain cost up to a point, and then they can take as many credits as they want to. Well, all of our universities had a plateau in effect about 10 years ago. None of them have it anymore. So there is clearly the schools are really working with the balance of students and getting them in seats in classes. And we've been pushing them on ensuring that they're offering full classes on their campuses.
I'd like to just highlight the work of Western, because I think that their tuition promise idea is a step. As Representative Johnson had mentioned, all the technical and regional campuses are working on these issues in some way. When the Western tuition promise began in 2007, Western had the lowest tuition rate of all the Oregon universities. Now, they promised their students, we will not raise tuition for you for the years that you're at Western getting a degree. Because of the state defunding, Western had to raise tuition in order to keep their promise. So now Western has one of the highest tuitions among the institutions. So that's certainly, that's not something, they're proud of the Western promise, but not proud that they've had to raise tuition rates. So just some information for you to keep in mind. The success of the students that we want to reach through a program like this, those students are not the students that have been successful in college in the past or in getting into college. And so we all know that it costs more money. We have tutoring centers and experiences for students that are more costly than the students who have traditionally gone to college. So we do need to keep those costs in consideration, and I think the ideas in the Dash 1 Amendment are going to do that. So we're happy to continue the conversation, and we're happy to continue to work with the state on these innovative ideas. And so I'd just like to remind you to keep in mind all the changes that the technical and regionals are going through at this time. And we want to make sure that we're thinking systematically about these approaches and not just picking things one-off. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Mark Perlman. I'm a philosophy professor at Western Oregon University, and I'm also president of the faculty union at WOU. And I'm here to raise questions about House Bill 4076. And I don't know all the details behind the scenes or the amendments. I just know what the actual bill says. And as an educator, I, of course, agree with the goals of making higher education more affordable and lowering tuition costs. But I only agree with that if we retain high quality in our education. And the thing that worries me about this bill is that it seems that it has the potential of eroding the quality of the degrees that it gives by having them be at a reduced cost. Ultimately, there are lots of complex problems in the world, but why there are high tuitions at Oregon's public universities is not one of those. It's a very simple reason. The state legislature and the state of Oregon has cut funding of higher ed for the last 30 years. In the last 7 years, Western has had its budget cut by 30%. And that's with increasing numbers of students. We've had our budget cut by 30%. Now in K-12, when the budget for education gets cut, the only option is to reduce quality. We have teacher layoffs and increased class sizes, and we eliminate programs and we shorten the school district, and the whole country gets to make fun of the fact that Portland schools have the lowest number of days in the year. In the university system, there are two options. One is to reduce the quality and the value of the degrees and risk losing our accreditation. The other option is to raise tuition. And since the first one was totally unacceptable, we raised tuition. There is no other choice. And we all know what the cause is, and that is disinvestment in higher education. And we've dumped the cost of college onto the backs of the students. So tuition has gone up. It's really pretty simple. The obvious solution is to fund the university system, not to ignore the cause of the problem. And I don't think we need to spend 5 years doing pilot studies on figuring out how to lower tuition. We already know how to lower tuition. That is, have the state contribute the share of educating people that they used to contribute and that we have been drawing down from for a couple of decades. The other thing that I would like to this whole idea of fixed cost degrees seems dangerously close to me to sort of outsourcing education to the lowest bidder. And we have all these online for-profit universities that sound great. You know, you can get everything. You don't even have to show up. You just log in. But what I worry about is the quality of the education that people get through those kinds of programs. And I don't think we need to be lowering the quality. I think we need to be raising the quality of education. And online learning, distance learning, they may have their place, but I don't think that they're a replacement for having personal contact between highly qualified faculty and students. And there's this trend nationally that I find very alarming of, well, we can just pump people out for a low cost, and as long as they press the right buttons on the online program, we'll call them educated enough to get a degree. And I don't think that that's how education should work. I'm not saying this bill guarantees that we would go in that direction, but it sort of invites us to go in that direction. The most important thing, and you already heard about this, my university, Western Oregon University, we've already not just piloted fixed cost degrees, we have fixed cost degrees. In 2007, we had the tuition promise. You pay the same tuition for 4 years. And if you manage things correctly and you're diligent, you can finish your degree in 4 years and have a flat tuition for those 4 years. And we kept our promise. We're still keeping our promise. Everybody who is in that program has finished with a flat tuition for 4 years, but it hasn't been easy. And there's exactly one reason why we have had so much difficulty. At the very beginning, when we established the tuition promise, it was predicated on a very simple premise. The legislature has to fund the university at a level that will sustain the tuition promise. Now, I remember there was this little thing, the Great Recession, that happened shortly after that, which threw a monkey wrench into it. But there's a one simple reason why the tuition promise got to be a problem, and that's because our funding got pulled 30% at a time when we were promising not to raise tuition to these people. So instead what happens is each subsequent class has to start at a significantly higher level to be promised a fixed tuition, and the incoming classes this year have the highest starting tuition. I haven't crunched all the numbers, but I still bet that if we compare that to the highest beginning tuition guaranteed over 4 years versus how much their tuition is going to go up if they went someplace like U of O, I think they'd still be doing well at our high starting tuition. But the fact that we had the rug pulled out from under us in fixed cost bachelor's degrees is why the program hasn't been doing swimmingly well. And at Western now has a sort of two-tier system. You still can do the tuition promise, guaranteed for 4 years, but it's not as cheap as you would like. And if you want a lower tuition this year, then you go on the flexible plan, in which case every year it's probably going to go up, depending on state appropriations, which, well, okay, let's admit it's going to go up. So I think we've done some of the work. We know how to do a fixed cost four-year bachelor's degree, and we know how to make it cost something that students can afford. But we need the state to do their part, and the state hasn't done their part. And I do agree with what it says in the bill. We have an emergency. But the emergency has one simple source. We keep getting our budget cut. Then at the last line, or the last section of the bill, it says, well, the universities will make recommendations for state incentives and appropriations that may be necessary. Every session, the universities come to the legislature and make recommendations. And you all are fully aware of what happens when we make recommendations about funding. We don't get what we recommend, and we can't provide the services that we need. And what I'm worried most about is that the potential here is that we're going to end up having a massive unfunded mandate, that we have these low-cost, fixed-cost degrees, but we're not going to pay for them. And if they're fixed cost without getting support, they won't be worth what they need to be worth for people to enter the workforce. And the situation about funding has gotten so bad that, as you all know, the three largest universities have bailed out of the university system and they want their own boards. And it basically is because they have virtually given up on the hope that things will get better. So they figured, well, if we have independent boards, we can raise money and we can just give up on the legislature giving us anything. And it happened. So I would rather us not to give up on public education, but to fund public education. And I don't see that this bill is going to do anything about that. And it sort of seems to me like excessive regulation of the four schools that remain in the Oregon University system, at least for a while, because Western's already announced their plans to seek an independent board as well. We don't need a law to get all of these things done. We explore innovative programs all the time, and we're going to do that anyway. What we need is not a law to tell us to do it. We need funding to do it, and this doesn't provide that. We know how to do what we need to do, but we don't get the support we need to accomplish it. I'm as enthusiastic as anyone about the goal of 40-40-20. It's a great goal, but I've noticed that it requires a large investment that nobody seems to be talking about making. And it's a great goal if you pay for it. And there's this truism, you get what you pay for. And if you want to not pay for something, you're not going to get what you hoped. So I'm hoping that instead we just invest in public education. But I don't see that mandating us to offer cut-rate degrees is going to fulfill the needs that we have when we all know what the needs are. So, and I'm not saying that, you know, parts of this don't have merit, but it ignores the main problem. Now, maybe that's because the main problem is so hard that we can't figure out how to solve it, but I would rather we just solve the problem instead of making it like an end run around it. So I'm sorry if I sound too grumpy, but it, you know, 8 o'clock's too early for me to get up. But I'm happy to answer any questions that you have, and thank you all for listening.
Okay, thank you both for joining us, and I think some grumpiness is appropriate. So, questions, comments, Jeff Greenlick.
Yeah, I remember I didn't like to teach 8 o'clock classes either. I'll start this by saying I voted against the higher ed budget, I believe, every single session. I may have voted in favor of it once for exactly the point. But reading your testimony, your written testimony, makes it seem pretty easy. We just need to give more money to higher ed. I made a couple of assumptions. One, it's very hard to get a tax increase through to the voters, although it's been said I've never seen a tax I didn't like. But when you start with the assumption that the voters aren't going to approve a tax increase, and you have 92% or 93% of the budget going to education, social services, the criminal justice system, I wonder if you have a suggestion of which of those areas we ought to cut by an extra few million dollars or biennium to give the money to higher ed, which I'd love to support.
Well, I mean, I think
it isn't a problem. We're just giving money to higher ed.
Well, I mean, I understand that it's a big problem. Finding a large sum of money is a big problem, but and it requires a serious look at the entire tax structure. But we have to recognize that Oregon is near the very bottom of the country. That 45 states have done way better than Oregon has done on this, and there's got to be a reason for that. And so it seems to me that some of those states may have something to show us about how they managed to fund things better than Oregon has. I mean, it's shameful that Oregon is at the very, very bottom of the entire country for education.
No, I agree with you. So let's stipulate that. The question is, what is it you propose we do that's so easy about just getting an extra $50 million? I mean, if we take it out of the prison system, if we take it out of K-12, should we take it out of services for the elderly and the disabled? I mean,
I think the number one thing would be to get rid of all of the kickers.
Yeah, that would be a nice thing, but it's not going to happen. Because it requires a lot of the citizens to change the Constitution. I agree. I'd get rid of that. I'd add a sales tax. I'd do any of those things that can't happen. The question is, what can you propose that actually can't happen? I know as a professor of philosophy, you don't have to worry too much about the real world. You can make up the world you want to deal with. But could you?
Unfortunately, I live in the real world.
gentlemen, interesting discussion. Certainly one that's germane to everything we do in the building. But let's try to stick to the bill here. And
I was just trying to the testimony,
I understand.
Which is before us.
I understand. We could maybe take that offline. because we would all appreciate help with the challenges here. If there are no more questions, comments right now, I'll thank you both, Drs. Perlman and Maringel.
Thank you.
And invite up the next and last panel, I believe, which is Eric Knoll again, and Andrea Henderson, if you're still here, please.
I bet it didn't.
Take it away. It's in your hand.
Chair Harker, Vice Chairs Gallegos and Hoffman, and members of the committee, good morning, and thank you again for the opportunity to speak with you. For the record, my name is Eric Knoll, Chair, OSA Board of Directors. Today I'm testifying in favor of House Bill 4076 and in favor of the accompanying Dash 1 amendment. At this stage in the bill's development, OSA is tentatively supporting House Bill 4076. Students have questions related to this bill and requests that more research is done related to the financial and workload impact at the institutions specified in the bill. We have the following questions regarding the implementation of the proposed pilot programs and implementation of the bill, including but not limited to. What are the costs of resources and labor related to research and implementation of these pilot programs? Where will our institutions find funding for these pilot programs? Will fixed-cost bachelor degrees push low-income students towards certain degrees? And will a fixed-cost bachelor degree result in certain degrees being prioritized over others? And we will have other questions as the bill continues to develop. Now, while we have many questions and are concerned about the details of this bill being too broad at this stage, students see opportunities to continue important conversations about affordability at post-secondary institutions. This provides yet another prospect for the state and universities to address the issues of student debt and rising tuition. These ideas are worth investigating and should be a priority of educators and legislators in a time when student debt and tuition prices are at an all-time high. Students are eager to seek solutions in this crisis and are willing to explore options that may result in the desired solutions. In reference to the Dash 1 amendment, we support the proposed proposal to amend House Bill 4076 with language that is more specific to the role of the HEC and further addresses the issue of long-term financial sustainability. We strongly advocate for a quality, affordable, and accessible education for all Oregonians, and at the same time recognize the need for this long-term financial stability. We believe this bill aligns exactly with the purpose of the HEC, to research and help implement policies that increase access and move the state closer to our 40-40-20 and completion goals. OSA is recommending that the House Higher Ed and Workforce Development Committee work to address the questions students have relating to the effect of the bill and offer our support as this conversation develops. Thank you for your time, and I'll answer any questions if you have them.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Harker, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Andrea Henderson from the Oregon Community College Association. And we had a conversation amongst the presidents last week at our meeting regarding this bill, and really see this as Representative Johnson mentioned, one of the tools to look at how we move towards the 40-40-20. Increasing the completion and graduation rates is so critical right now to Oregon. And in community colleges is a large part of our conversation in terms of how can we develop our systems differently, how can we use technology differently, how can we take a look creatively to increase the attainment of our citizens. And we think this is one of the tools to look at this. This current bill doesn't directly direct the community colleges, but certainly anticipates a partnership with the community colleges to help the regional and technical universities with developing the fixed-cost degrees. And certainly from the presence of the community colleges, they're very eager to enter into that partnership and creatively think with our partners at the universities how we might increase a fixed cost degree and have better pathways for our students in Oregon. So just wanted to represent the community college perspective on this, and thank you for your time.
Thanks to both of you. Questions, comments?
Yeah, I mean, this is a important an interesting bill. I think I think we need to welcome any kind of innovative thinking and approaches. I mean, in a way, I was reminded of in healthcare how, in the 80s, we developed the diagnostic-related groupings in an effort to reduce healthcare costs that were just skyrocketing. And I'm trying to think of this as a similar kind of effort to try to think about how can we contain some of those exploding costs. So I'm very much in favor of this as an innovative approach to dealing with cost issues, recognizing though that again the elephant in the room is our lack of a sustainable and stable revenue system in this state. I would be interested in seeing the reports, I assume, or the data that related to Texas, Florida, and Wisconsin to see how those programs developed and what their assessment is. One thing I'm thinking about is that we also have a monitoring system within the academic arena, which is called accreditation. And I can only assume that accreditation would be monitoring this kind of effort as well. So, on the other hand, I am concerned too about what the effect would be on the actual educational experience for the students, for the faculty. But anyway, all that said, it's an interesting concept, and at this point I'm ready to sort of support going through with it, but we'll see.
Yeah, Rep. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, just to address Rep. Gallegos's comments about other programs in other states. My office, we have that information. I'd be happy to make that available.
Yeah, yeah, please,
committee members, forward that on to you. No question.
Anything else? We have a lot to think about on this one. Thank you both for your testimony, and I appreciate the community college perspective here as well as the students. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. That being the case, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4076. And we are still scheduled for 8 a.m. Friday morning.
Nice.
Look at all those smiles.
So,
anything else for the good of the order except the enthusiasm for starting at 8?
Or leaving early?
All right.
Good.
Let's go. We're adjourned.
Getting the heck out of town.
We're adjourned.
Getting the heck out of town.
What's for